Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Prince Caspian, The Chronicles of Narnia. Or I guess that goes the other way. The Chronicles of Narnia, colon, Prince Caspian. Part two of the series from the Chronicles of Narnia books. I'm here with John Swansburg. Hi, John.
Hello.
Who is a culture editor at Slate and also our resident Narniologist, who I took to the movie with me. Not dragged. He was eager to go.
I was eager, I'm embarrassed to admit.
Because unlike me, he was a fan of the books as a child. I read the first, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a child and was never able to get into it or any fantasy genre book really as a kid. I should take another look now because I don't dispute that it's probably a wonderfully written book. But
I've actually reread them in my adulthood and it was quite pleasing. But then again, as a fan.
Oh, you are well suited for this
podcast.
Yeah,
it was in college. It was a while ago. So I'm probably a little bit rusty, but it was fun to reread them because I had no idea when I was a kid, obviously, about all the Christian allegory. And so it was kind of cool to come back
and visit.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about all that for sure. Let's just quickly summarize the story for those who haven't read the books. So we start off in London, wartime London, right? Second
yes.
World War. And we have the four Pevensey children. Is mm-hmm. that how you say their last
Pevensey,
name?
Pevensey? I'm not exactly sure.
And their names are, in descending order of age, Peter, Susan,
Edmund,
Lucy.
Correct.
Descending from maybe 15 years old to about 9 or 10, something
I
like that.
I think that's right.
And as they're standing in a London train station one dreary day, they suddenly are swept through a mysterious portal that takes them back to, and here's where you'll take it away with the terminology.
Right. So they end up at Caer Paravel, which is the castle that they ruled from at the end of the first book. But now the castle's no longer there. It's in ruins. It sort of takes them a little while to figure that out. I think this is in the trailer, that moment of discovery when they realize that they're back at their old castle. But it's
because one year has passed in their lives since they first
exactly.
went to Narnia, but 1,300 years have
something,
passed.
Yeah, something like 1,300 years. I think that's the number. So a lot has happened in Narnian history since then, even though not much has happened in their lives and they're not much older. So what they discover is that the Narnians, as they knew them, who were sort of this happy band of like mythological creatures like centaurs and just like talking beasts like, badgers who keep home and make soup and eat, crusty bread.
That's a good world. I want to live in
it. It is a very charming
crusty
world.
Crusty badgers.
Yeah,
crusty
and the beavers badges. From the first one were always really charming to me. They were great. So all those folks that we came to adore in the first book are ostensibly gone, and Narnia is a world of men, human beings.
Who are called in that world Telmarines.
Telmarines, I believe. So we learn a little bit more about their background later, but for our purposes, we find out that the Narnians have been made extinct, or so the Telmarines think. They actually are still alive, but sort of living in the underground or in the woods, far away from most of the Narnian lands. And the story is that I guess the first thing we see is Prince Caspian is the sort of heir to the throne of Narnia now, and he's a Telmarine. And but he's too young, so he's not actually in power as the king. This other guy named Miraz is sort of like the regent. He's kind of guiding Narnian policy until Caspian is old enough to take over.
Wouldn't that make Caspian the regent?
Would it?
I think so. I think the regent is what you call the young man who's waiting to rule, no?
I feel like I read in one of the pieces that I read that he was the regent. The only reason that word is in my head, but you might be right.
Anyway, I have no idea. I know that word applies to that situation, but I'm not sure which one. Anyway.
So Prince Caspian is going to take over the throne eventually, but Miraz has other ideas. And Miraz, the first thing we see is he has a baby, and so now he has an heir, and he wants to basically seize power. So he's going to kill Caspian so that he can do that, so that he can consolidate his power. But Caspian is spirited off into the woods before he can be killed by the evil Miraz. And sort of the plot as it unfolds from there, just to do it as quickly as possible, is that he spirits off into the woods. He's given by his professor a sort of relic of the old Narnia, which is a horn, which he blows because he's in trouble and about to get caught by the evil Telmarine forces.
And that's how he summons the school
and
children.
And that's essentially how he summons the Pevensey children from London to Narnia. And eventually the two meet up. Prince Caspian meets up with the Pevensey children and sort of updates them on the dire situation Narnia finds itself in, and they kind of band together and vow to bring Narnia back to the Narnians and fight the evil Telmarines, and a series of battles sort of unfold from there. Was there something else that we wanted to...
I think that's
basically
sort of a summary from there. I think we can get spoiling from there.
Yeah, I think so.
So the first thing we wanted to attack is the whole question of religion in this movie, which I'm sure people are going to be curious about because, as everyone knows, the C.S. Lewis novels are basically Christian parables, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you would call them parables. They're pretty thinly disguised,
yeah.
you know, Christian stories in which there's an actual Christ figure, the lion Aslan, who dies at the end of the first novel and movie.
And is resurrected.
And he reappears in this movie, and this is some of the stuff that I want to spoil, is how he reappears and how his reappearance is sort of used as a Christian symbol.
Right. I mean, I had forgotten when exactly he came back, or if he came back in this book, I confess. And we first see him in a dream that one of the children, Lucy, has. And Lucy is sort of always the most faithful of the children. She is the first one to go to Narnia through the wardrobe and sort of tells her siblings about it, and they all think that she's got a screw loose.
Essentially, it seems like in C.S. Lewis's eyes, that must be because she's the youngest, right?
And yeah,
she's
I think
the most in touch with her spiritual side.
I think that's precisely it. And so she sees Aslan in a dream, and we don't know exactly if that's going to be all we see of this god figure. But in fact, he does come back at the very end to sort of basically save the day and deliver the kind of final crushing blow to the Telmarine forces who are sort of in retreat already, but without Aslan's sort of last roar.
And in a very Christian moment when he saves the day, his huge roar summons this kind of water god, right?
Right.
The climactic battle that takes place is the Telmarines are riding across a bridge, right, on the other side of which stand the lion and the little girl. And after this big roar, it's almost as if he's calling his father, right, because this river god appears who basically, it's a really cool digital effect, is sort of the river become a man.
Right.
Who looks to me exactly like an Old Testament god in an old-fashioned Bible illustration.
Yeah,
a big, bearded, white guy.
Right. And he basically swallows them up in a moment that's not unsuggestive of the Egyptian forces being swallowed by the Red Sea in Exodus as well. So yeah, I mean, that's not exactly a subtle work there that the movie or the books are doing. I mean, in general, I know that these movies have been somewhat controversial because of the religion thing. I didn't find that the movies, this one or the previous ones, sort of laid it on any thicker than the books did. If anything, they might even be a little bit more.
Oh yeah, it's not quite a critique of the movie. I mean, it's really of the story itself to say that, you know, things get a little heavy-handedly Christian. I mean, we were discussing this last night. I was trying to talk about why I couldn't get into the books as a child, and I'm sure I was too young, although I was probably 11 or 12 when I read them. I had some idea of, you know, what kind of a fable or parable might be, but I'm sure I didn't get that they were Christian.
Right.
But there was something about the ending and about the resurrection of the lion at the end of the first one, which I say is the only one I read, that did kind of creep me out. And I now realize that it was probably the 10-year-old seeds of my adult atheism already being put in place. I
mean,
the end of this movie to me essentially seems like a brief on behalf of religious warfare, right?
I mean,
it's all about being on the righteous side and getting God on your side, and everybody who's on the wrong side, all the Telmarine soldiers on that bridge, you know, basically die horribly.
Right.
And yet it's a happy ending for the movie. And there's just something about that, especially as a kid's movie, that just left me with a queasy feeling. Although I know children's fantasy worlds are probably very righteous and black and white and exactly that way.
Sure. And the other thing that's strange about this from the theological perspective is it sort of it raises this question throughout the movie, because Aslan sort of shows up only as he's sort of like the deus ex machina at the very end of the film. He is always held up as this powerful figure, but a powerful figure who's completely absent. And all of the Narnians, I mean, some of them believe that he exists, some of them don't. Some of them have basically feel like he's been gone for so long that and they've suffered such awful times in his absence that they sort of start questioning whether he exists at all. And then, you know, in the end, he does show up and sort of saves the day. But in the meantime, the Narnians have been suffering for like 1,000 years, and, you know, untold Narnians die in several battle scenes in this movie. And finally, Aslan sort of sees fit to show up and kick some ass. But, I mean, it does raise the question. I would think if I were a 9-year-old, I could see myself walking out and asking my dad, what was Aslan doing all that time? Why did he have to wait to come back and save the day? It's never made clear what he was doing, you know, while all these bad things were happening. And I think that's sort of one question that people who don't cotton to, you know, Judeo-Christian theology always raise. It's like, you know, if God is omnipotent, you know, why does he allow suffering to happen? And that question is very much raised by this movie. And I don't know that satisfactorily answered even for a 12-year-old or 10-year-old mind.
Right, yeah. I mean, that question, it's called the theodicy, right? That's
right.
Like actually an ancient medieval, you know, debate topic that they would sit around and debate, well, how could God allow evil to exist in the world? And,
right.
You know, obviously there were, you know, 1,000 medieval ways of explaining what angels could dance on the head of a pin, so that would happen. But yeah, any smart 9-year-old would sort of say, well, what makes this war different from all the other wars or all the other, you know, moments in the last 1,300 years when the Narnians might have needed some help?
Right.
There are a lot of little deus ex machina at the end that sort of get under your skin if you've got a problem with that kind of story resolution. Another one is that, maybe this is explained better in the books, but that strange sort of anti-death juice that Lucy, right, the littlest girl, carries around with her in this sort of holster in her, you know, little medieval, what do you call it where you keep a sword?
Scabbard.
Not a holster, a scabbard.
Right.
She's got this little bottle, like a perfume bottle, and it's never quite explained why, but if you drip this into the mouth of someone who's apparently just died in battle, they come back to life.
Right, and like...
Which makes for two very unsuspenseful deaths of Peter Dinklage's really wonderful, I thought, dwarf character.
Mm-hmm.
What's that character's name? Trumpkin.
Trumpkin, that's right. Yeah, he's sort of the good dwarf, and there's also a bad dwarf.
I personally love Peter Dinklage, and the only thing that made me sad is that his makeup made him look less hot than he usually does. He's got to be the hottest small guy on screen, but he's got a big bulbous nose and is sort of aged artificially for this role. Anyway, after Trumpkin dies, he's brought back to life by the magic juice.
Right.
And the same for this little mouse character.
Right, Reepa Sheep, who will play a big role in the next book and no doubt the upcoming film, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Yeah, it's at the end of both the first book and this book, there's sort of like a chosen couple of people get that little drop of you know, rejuvenating Narnia Gatorade and get saved. But meanwhile, like all these other people, all these centaurs who fought bravely and et cetera, like those people just die. And it's not really clear why Lucy decides to give a drop here and there to these chosen people. It's a little bit of a strange decision.
In addition to being, you know, if you're someone who is rubbed the wrong way by a certain kind of Santa Claus presentation of religion,
right,
that could bother you. But also just purely as a story element, it's just not that suspenseful if every major character that dies immediately comes back. I mean,
right,
seconds after you see them being carried in on a gurney.
Yeah, exactly. It takes something away from that anticipation there. I mean, and just in general, I mean, I walked away from this movie like being reminded of sort of how this story of this particular book in the Chronicles was maybe one of the weakest stories. It just the villain, this King Miraz, who's the sort of king of the usurper king of the Telmarines. He's just sort of not that interesting a character. I mean, he's compared to
Tilda Swinton's White Witch.
Exactly. And Tilda Swinton's White Witch, this is to spoil a little bit, makes a sort of cameo in this movie. And she's so much scarier in this sort of minute and a half scene than anything that the king or any of his henchmen do.
She's gripping.
She's really gripping, and it makes you sort of pine for the first movie where her sort of charismatic bad guy character really kind of lent some drama to this. Here, you know that Miraz is never really going to succeed at the end of the day, and he's just sort of like your run of the mill bad king. He's not that interesting a character, and we don't really know that much about him. We learn sort of vaguely in the middle that he killed Caspian's father in a power grab, but you know, he's also just a human. Like, he's not, there's nothing magical about
right,
him.
He's
you know,
just
like,
a mortal guy.
Right. Whereas the queen, you know, could muster Turkish delight at the snap of a finger. I mean, that's pretty scary.
I will say that, I mean, it makes me want to go back and see Tilda Swinton in the first one, because the magic side of this movie, this is, I think, is the strong point of the movie, and I think you agreed with me on this, is that the way that it evokes childhood fantasy and the idea of escaping to a world where even if you're 12 years old, you can be a king and a great warrior and, you know, the greatest archer in history is really kind of wonderful and endearing. And I liked all of the parable about childhood, as much as I didn't like all the parables about Christianity.
Exactly. No, I think that in the end is the more powerful mythology, is the mythology of childhood and also of imagination and the ability. I mean, particularly in the first book, we know that these children are escaping from the Blitz and are separated from their parents, and they're going to live with this strange relation in the country in Britain. And sort of the idea that they would escape to this imaginary world because they're just not quite capable of dealing with reality is quite powerful. Here, that aspect of the story is not quite as present, but there are moments in the beginning and at the end where that comes in. I mentioned to you one of the scenes I liked a lot was in the beginning. Peter and Edmund, we first see them, are fighting in a fist fight with some of their classmates from their public school. And you kind of get the sense that these kids who were kings for 100 years in Narnia are having a really hard time adjusting to life back in Britain, wartime Britain, where they're no longer royalty, and some kid like cuts them or steals their lunch money, and they have to deal with that without a sword or a lion king, and they're having a rough go of it. And then at the end, there's this moment that I found kind of powerful and actually choked me up a little bit, I'm embarrassed to say, but one of the things that happens in this book is that Peter and Susan, who are the elder of the Pevensey children, are told by Aslan that this is sort of their last go of it in Narnia, that they're sort of too old. They're getting pubescent, and as such, they're sort of no longer going to have a role to play in the history of Narnia. And that's sort of a really evocative for me. I don't know if it was for you, but I just kind of – I had this moment of being like, oh, it's the end of childhood. And that was sort of meant more to me than any of the other allegorical stuff in the movie.
I agree. I found that very moving, and I was surprised I could be moved in the last couple minutes of a movie, which I didn't hate, far from it. But there was a lot of sort of yawning through the clanking
sure.
sword fights and the prancing centaurs, and there was a lot of fantasy element, you know, so
yeah.
you really have to be a fantasy person to get very into the 2 hours and 20 minutes of this movie. But I agree, when it very simply at the end, like all the great classics of children's literature, like Alice in Wonderland, like so many, you know, children's books, becomes about that moment of getting too old and slipping from childhood back to the real world.
Right.
Yeah, who wouldn't get choked up, is very nicely done.
I agree.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for seeing the movie with me and bringing your Narnia knowledge to the table.
My pleasure. I hope it served.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.